It is impossible to be a bag of grapes. It just didn't work by yourself. Because as soon as somebody comes to speak to your heart about a matter, you want to get defensive. As soon as somebody rubs you the wrong way, you come up with all kinds of excuses as to why you're right and that person's an idiot. Now, you don't say that, okay? But that's what you're thinking. Who are you to correct me? Do you have any idea what I have been through? Do you have any idea what my background and experience is? And here you are thinking that you can point out something in my life that I need to correct. So instantly the walls go up, and sometimes the claws come out. And with our words, we want to swipe back. Oh, yeah? So you think you got it all together, huh? Which indicates we want to pull back and become a bag of marbles. We only bounce off of each other from time to time when we absolutely have to. The whole idea of becoming a bag of grapes, becoming part of the stuff, becoming a body, becoming a family, a flock, a tribe, functioning as a whole. Not just downright scary. When we were designing this room, the question came, what are we going to sit on? Are we going to sit on chairs? Sit on those theater seats? And I didn't have a whole lot of input, because I didn't want to have a whole lot of input. I didn't want to get blamed. But I did make a request. And it was pews. Because we're not marbles who sit and function all by ourselves. We're a body. And I think one of the things that a pew does is at least, you know, people's stuff lays next to you. You can lean on your mom if you need to. You know, you can sit next to somebody and to some way reflect a bag of grapes. The book of Romans is about the gospel. But a gospel that calls us to become a bag of grapes. In one hand, the first 11 chapters are theologically rich, deep, particularly 9, 10, and 11, and plowing through the doctrine of foreknowledge and the doctrine of predestination and the doctrine of calling, and understanding then the doctrine of justification, and then going back in chapters 6, 7, and 8 and looking at sanctification and getting just a bit of a taste of glorification, some of that stuff can start to make your head hurt. But Paul didn't stop at the end of chapter 11, did he? In fact, I think you can argue that wasn't his main goal. Just to lay out a defense of the theology of the gospel. When you look at chapter 12, which I invite you to do, you'll notice that it begins with the word therefore. Here's where we've been going all along. Here's what I want you to get. Here is a section that, like the doctrine of sin, and like the doctrine of salvation, and like the doctrine of sanctification, and like the doctrine of sovereignty, is part of the gospel. Tonight we're starting to plow through the last major section of the book of Romans, chapter 12, verse 1 through chapter 15 and verse number 13, which is on service, serving, connecting. You can write above that, chapter 12, bag of grapes. Let's go back. The book of Romans is about what big idea? Oh, man. You know, there's this whole thing that says, if the students aren't learning, the teacher isn't teaching. You're making me feel like a total failure. So in order to help my self-esteem, which is your job, isn't it, to build me up? No. What is the book of Romans about? Oh, I feel so much better about myself. Until I start to look at the gospel, right? Because it starts off with the doctrine of what? Sin. After the introduction, we learn about sin. You want to learn about your own sin? Start studying chapter 12. Oh. Because in this final section of Romans, Paul talks about how we engage with each other, our relationships with each other. And you talk about something that brings out the evil that is in our own hearts. And you get into a conversation, you get into a situation, and you say, "Oh, I can't believe I said that. Oh, I didn't mean that. That came out of my mouth." Yeah. Why? Because of the evil that is inherent right there already. Chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 20 deals with the doctrine of sin. Oh. That is so critical for us to continually grasp and to allow that to humble us and come to grips with that. And we will be confronted with that right away in the beginning of chapter 12. Understanding our need, which is what the doctrine of sin explains, then in chapter 3, verse 21, through the end of chapter 5, which is verse 21, we learn the doctrine of what, class? Salvation. Sin, salvation. The person comes up to you and you get into a relationship with somebody, you're talking with somebody, and they want to know, what does it mean to be a follower of Christ? Like, oh, and you think, man, I need a class. No, you don't. You got Romans. Okay? Just say, great question. Let's read Romans. You can do that. And you can start in chapter 1, verse 18, where it says that immoral people are sinners, moral people are sinners, religious people are sinners, everybody is a sinner. And now you can just read what is the solution to that. Chapter 3, verse 21 through chapter 5, verse 21. And it's Christ and Christ alone, who lived the life that I could never live, died the death I could never die. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 deal with how you grow as a follower of Jesus Christ. The third major section of the book of Romans, which is what? The doctrine of sanctification. So the first one is what? Sin. Second one is what? Third one is? And then we come to chapters 9, 10, and 11, dealing with the sovereignty of God. Which shows that what God has committed Himself to in chapter 8 We know that in all things God works for the good of those who are the loved, who are the called according to His purpose. For those He foreknew, He predestined. Those He predestined, He called. Those He called, He justified. Those He justified, He glorified. God finishes what He starts. How do we know that? What about Israel? A lot of that is unpacked in chapters 9, 10, and 11. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable His judgments and His paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Who has been His counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay? For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To Him be the glory forever. Amen. Therefore, chapter 12, verse 1, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy. You know, this is an interesting picture that he paints, isn't it? To offer your bodies as living dead things, as living sacrifices. What is a sacrifice? It's something you put on an altar. It's something that you kill or you burn up. It's in view of God's mercy, in view of the fact that God in His mercy breathed life into your heart and gave you eyes to see what you never saw before, Christ and His beauty. And gave you a heart that began to beat after the gospel. And you loved and you looked to and you accepted the gospel. Why? It wasn't because you were smarter. It wasn't because you were more gifted. It wasn't because of the blood that was in your veins. It's God's mercy. We love Him because He first loved us. So in view of God's mercy, what's there left to do? It's not to say, okay, I got my get out of hell free card now. I can just go and live however I want to live. No! You're called. It's not your life. Offer your bodies. This gets real practical. As living sacrifices. Holy, pleasing. This is your... The NIV translates it spiritual. In the footnote, it has reasonable. The Greek word actually has to do with being logical. It's the only logic... I mean, you think of it. This is the only logical thing to do. Any excuse that you and I may have as to why we do not have to obey God, we don't have to really follow Him with abandon, is illogical. But do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. All right, what is the pattern of this world? The pattern of this world is... It's all about me. I make the rules. I get to do what I want to do, and everybody else has to adjust. The pattern of this world is image. I will put before you an image that I want you to have of me, and I'll do everything I can to promote that image. And I want you to get close enough to find out that that isn't real. That's the pattern of this world. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So the change that the gospel brings about in our lives is not from the outside in, it's from the inside out. What I have to do is preach the gospel to myself. What I have to do is hear you preach the gospel to me. I have incredible blind spots in my own life. I need relationships based upon the gospel, where people will help point out those blind spots. And I need the grace of God to minister to my heart in such a way that I break down the walls, I get rid of the fangs and the claws, and I listen. And I sift and I evaluate. And I cry out to God to hear. The gospel helps me do that because the gospel teaches me that I am a first-rate, class A sinner. And as a sinner, I'm humbled. And in humility, I listen. You can't teach somebody who knows everything. And then, and I'm able to test, to prove what God's will is. What's His will? His will is to make us like Christ. And He uses the body to do that. Some of you are absolutely scared to death of relationships. You find things wrong with everybody. Well, are there things wrong with everybody? Yes. Yes. So, for you to say, well, I find things wrong with everybody, that's brilliant. All right? That's what the first doctrine's about. Yes, we're all guilty of that. That is not rocket science. But for you to respond to that as a reason for why they can't speak to your heart and why you don't want to get close to them robs you of living out the gospel and the whole process that God has designed the body to be about, to make you into the image of Jesus Christ. So in these chapters we see, particularly here in verses 3 through 8, how to see your part in the church. Now, there's a lot of different ministries in the church. And here's how you should not see yourself as part of the church. Let's say you have, like Ken and Karen, you have a responsibility of being a greeter, or you work at the guest services table, or as Ryan playing guitar, or David playing trombone, or Debbie singing in the choir. Those are jobs that we do. That's not a part of the church that we are. Notice how it is explained in verses 3 through 8. First of all, for by the grace given me, and this is where he covers the real heart of it, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you. Okay, all right, let's just be honest. How do you not do that? How do you not think of yourself more highly than you ought? Is anybody here ever guilty of doing that? Is anybody here? Some of you are not raising your hands. Anybody here because you're not thinking, you're thinking of yourself too highly, aren't you? Touché. That wasn't nice, was it? Here you are coming out on a Sunday night for me to do that to you. Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. Why not? Because of this doctrine of sin. How do I not do that? It is so easy for me to be judge and jury of everybody from a distance. And to rationalize that I'm not in need of a person like that with weaknesses to address issues in my own life. And what you see, this whole context here in Romans is a bag of grapes. It's a body that is relating to each other. There are relationships with tensions arise, which disagreements come up. That is expected. That is part of how we grow together. But if I'm thinking of myself more highly than I ought, then you got nothing to say to me in my mind. I can't learn anything from you. But if I think of myself with sober judgment, if I get the measurement of my life the way the doctrine of sin explains it, I'm humble. I'm so willing for anybody. I'm so desirous for anybody to help me. And right now at 6:35 on a Sunday night, that makes so much sense. It makes so much sense. But tomorrow morning when someone points out something that they didn't like about me, it won't make sense. And I'll be thinking of myself more highly than I ought. I need the gospel. I need Christ. Think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you. And then he goes on to explain that. And we saw this same idea in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 of the different gifts that God has given to the body, because it takes all of the parts to make the whole. Nobody has it all together. Nobody has all the gifts. Nobody has a perfect balance of all the gifts. Every single part needs the other parts. And that's the whole idea there. You've got to see your part in the church. You have got to see you need the church. You need the church so much. You need the body. Second part of this section deals with how to treat other believers. Oh, man. When you talk about a convicting section, you start reading through some of these things in verse 9 through verse 16. It is so convicting. Love must be sincere. I'm blown up on the first one. Some of you may know that back in the first century world in which Paul was writing, that if a particular piece of pottery came out of the kiln with cracks in it, that a craftsman who is less than honest would would take some wax and would fill those cracks in, then simply paint over it and sell it as if it was a completely perfect piece of pottery. So a trained buyer would learn to take the piece of pottery and hold it up before the sun, which would reveal those cracks that had been covered over. The word that is translated here, sincere, literally means without wax. It's a little dark idea. It's something that's, let your love be without trying to cover up. Let your love be just pure. I can't love that way myself. My heart constantly goes to, you know, if I love this person, they could love me back. In fact, if I love this person more than this person, I could probably get more from this person than I could get from that person. Now, you don't have to raise your hands on this one, but does anybody else think like that? Oh. And there are some days in which I just long to be able to be free from the curse of sin, to be able just to love perfectly without a thought of what I'm going to get in return. And someday I will. That's the hope of the gospel. I need the gospel to remind me that even in my imperfect, even in my loving, I need the grace of God to forgive me because I don't love perfectly yet. Hate what is evil, cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keeping your spiritual fervor, serving the Lord. What keeps you going? What keeps you fired up? Ultimately, it's the gospel. Being joyful in hope, being patient in affliction, being faithful in prayer. All of these things, if they are cut off from the gospel, are nothing more than Pharisaical lists of things to do. It's like parenting little children. All right? Tell them you're sorry. Sorry. And the heart just, you know. Or share. And that's not the spirit, is it? Share with God's people who are in need. It's an understanding that because of our sin, that the ground is level at the foot of the cross. And therefore, I've got nothing. Everything that I deserve, everything I have is a gift. Share. Practice hospitality. Practice hospitality with people who like the same sports teams that you do, right? Practice hospitality with people that have the same taste in music that you do. People who will not
mess up your house.
You know, practice hospitality with families that don't have little children because they may bump a few things and get things out of order, and you don't like things out of order. And it doesn't say that, does it? Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do you know of any organization or institution in this world, apart from the church, that carries that out? And we are so driven by what is, by our pride. We are so driven by positions. We are so driven by trying to get a step up on people. And we applaud those who are from their positions of power, who once in a while bend down and do a humanitarian deed. But so often it's done from a distance. It's done without really getting dirt underneath your fingernails. Verses 17 through 21, here's how you treat your enemy. You want to know how to destroy an enemy? You make him your friend. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Boy, that's hard. I worked with a guy that I think that if you put Judas Iscariot and Absalom together, you get this guy. And the scary thing was, it was in the context of a church, and it wasn't here. Now, he was smooth. And I knew what he was. I saw it. Saw through him. He one day threatened to kill a member of my family, literally. And you know, it was my dad he threatened to kill. And not long after that, my dad had a heart attack. And I was enraged. And I was plotting his destruction. And I'd convinced myself it was for the sake of the church. He needed to go down. And I had thought out how that would take place. And I convinced myself that was the right thing to do. And I remember being confronted with this truth: do not repay anyone evil for evil. But my situation was different. Paul wasn't thinking about me when he wrote this. Spirit of God had somebody else in mind. I had reasons. You go on, look at verse 19. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. Oh. I didn't think God was moving fast enough. I give him a little nudge. Here, let me help you out, God. What happens when we choose to become judge and jury in those kinds of situations, when we take upon ourselves a responsibility that God didn't give to us? This particular text makes it so clear, is that you start usurping the position of God. Okay, God, I'm going to do your job. He won't give you grace to do his job. He'll give you grace to do what he's called you to do. He won't give you grace for revenge. That's his job. And when you try to take over his job, he won't bless his competition. I remember the day that it seemed like everything kind of came to a head, and I had to make a decision what I was going to do. And the whole file that I had kept on it, that in a safe place in my computer, I knew I couldn't preach this truth and keep that file. Man, I tell you, it was war. There was the delete button right there. It was an act of faith. An act of belief in the truthfulness of God to delete and to take my hands off of a situation over which I had no control. He went into the hospital. He almost died. So I picked up the phone and I called him. Because I knew I needed to pray for him. Because if your enemy's hungry, you feed him. And if he's thirsty, you give him something to drink. How do you do that? It starts with the doctrine of sin, recognizing that you and I deserve the wrath of God. I deserve hell. If somebody threatens a family member's life, if somebody is being wicked to me and my family, I'm still better than I deserve. Oh, it's so easy to be overcome by evil. That's what happens if you repay anyone evil for evil. Verse 17. You repay someone evil for evil, then you end up getting overcome by evil.
And she started it.
Did you ever hear that in your home?
We did it first.
I used to say to my kids, you know, look, just because one person was stupid doesn't mean you have to be stupid in response. We got enough stupid here, you know what I mean? But that's what happens. You sin, and you sin, and you sin, and you sin, and you sin. Sin number one never, 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 never deserves sin number two. Sin number one never, 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 never deserves sin number two. A harsh word does not deserve a harsh word in return. And you can, if you can think the gospel, you can think that, then in the heat of the moment, in the home, when the energy and the intensity and the volume is starting to rise, sin number one never deserves sin number two. It doesn't. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Do not be overcome by evil. Now, she hurt me. So, I'll teach her. I'll give her the silent treatment. Gal came to my office one day. She was on her way to go see an attorney. She was going to divorce her husband. They'd been married for 30 years. 30 years. What a long time. And she was on her way to go see. I mean, she was literally heading to the attorney's office and stopped, pulled into the parking lot, and said, "Can I see a pastor?" And came in and told me that for 30 years, and she laid it all out, she's going to see an attorney. Do you get a divorce? Have you ever felt like you're in way over your head? You're thinking, "Oh, good night, nurse. I'm supposed to save this right now. Holy cow!" One of the things she told me was that one time he got so mad at her, he did not talk to her for 9 months. Did I hear that? 9 months. Nine months? Yeah. Now, what do you mean by he didn't talk to you? Do you mean that you didn't, you know, have this long conversation? No, he didn't talk.
You're telling me you guys lived underneath the same roof, and for 9 months there was no... No, he didn't say a word. Oh, man. I got to meet this guy. How do you do that?
Long story short, God put that marriage back together. An incredible story of His grace. And she was part of another. They were part of another church, and which was without a pastor at the time, and that's ended up got involved in their life. And that reminded me of it. It's just this past Christmas, they stopped me out here in the gathering space, came to the Christmas concert, and it's probably been good grief. That had to have happened 10, 12 years ago. What have they been doing for years? Repaying evil for evil. And each person had justified why they could respond in sin to the other. And after years of that kind of stuff going on, and all it took was for somebody to embrace the doctrine of sin and humble themselves and to acknowledge that I need a Savior. And the peace that brought into that situation was remarkable. And found out, my husband's not my enemy. Satan is. My wife's not my enemy. Satan is. How do you treat the government? That's verses 1 through 10. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from the one in authority? You want to be able to drive down the road without your heart bursting out of your chest when you see a police officer? Drive the speed limit. That's what it's saying. Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. For he is God's servant, an agent of wrath, to bring punishment on the evildoers. So what you have going on here is how God uses present realities to illustrate the eternal law, the eternal truths of life that is to come. What happens in a home when a child's not corrected and not loved, not disciplined? A child becomes angry. A child thinks he is the center of the world. Raise a child in a home and a child is not corrected, not loved enough to be told here are the boundaries. That home is not happy. Home is not calm or peaceful or relaxed. No way. What happens in a society when evil is not punished? When wickedness is never brought to justice? When bribery is the rule of the day? You read through Proverbs 29. Wow. Chaos and disaster reigns. There's unsettledness because even though you might be able to bribe your way into getting a favorable response from the government, there's always somebody who can overbribe you. There's no truth. There's no borders. There's no security. Present submission brings permanent freedom, while present rebellion brings permanent bondage. If you submit, you will rule. If you don't submit, you will be ruled. This is true in so many different ways. I tell my kids when it comes to finances, I've told them this for years. There's two kinds of people in the world when it comes to do with money. You will pay others forever to use their money, or somebody will pay you to use your money. Simple as that. The world doesn't tell you that. It gives you these credit cards. Do this, buy now, pay later, buy now, have this, you deserve it. So you buy it and buy it, and you're in bondage, you're ruled. But if you discipline yourself, if you submit to what God says about things, then you end up ruling. This is true financially. It's true morally. People think in terms of sexual immorality. Look, I can play the field. I can do what I want. Circumstantially, let me just talk to you a little bit about, just on the surface, what are some of the things that happen. Sexually transmitted diseases. Is that freedom? Oh, man. You talk about bondage. You talk about consequences. But the consequences go so much deeper than that. It's the issues of the heart. The memories, the guilt, the shame, the stuff that just can take years for some to work through. Present submission brings permanent freedom. Present rebellion brings permanent bondage. Either you control yourself or someone else will control you. What you have here in this section is that Paul speaks of obeying God means submitting to the authority structure that God has for you. If you don't learn the lessons that God intends for you to learn at home, then that job is given to the society. And the society doesn't care if you learn it or not. Israel rejected God's righteousness because they thought they had their own. They didn't submit to God's righteousness. What happened to Israel as a nation is an earthly illustration of an eternal truth. Israel rejected the leadership of the law. So God said, okay, I'll bring in someone who will still give you law. They won't do it in love. Hello, Rome. And so Rome destroyed Israel. Living for God means to do your part. Notice verse number 6. That's why you also pay taxes. Give what you owe. Don't give begrudgingly. That's hard for me. I'm in the middle of doing taxes right now. That's hard for me.
Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor.
Here's what you owe. Verse 8. You owe love. Let no debt remain outstanding. Except the continuing debt to love one another. You owe love to other believers. You are in debt to the body. How would that affect the dynamic of our family here? If we really got it into our DNA, man, I owe love to this body. Rather than saying, you owe me respect, you owe me a good sermon, you owe me a good service, you owe me a good song here and there. No. I owe the body love. Ooh. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law. And then Paul goes on to explain these commandments in terms of do not commit adultery. That's not loving. That's hateful. Do not murder. That's not loving. Stealing is not loving. Coveting is not loving. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to its neighbor. Love is the fulfillment of the law. I think one of the marks of maturity is seeing somebody grow beyond you, go beyond you, flourish, run faster, fly higher, go farther, and you be happy about it and rejoice with it. And if somebody preaches better than you, you rejoice. They sing better than you, you rejoice. Teach better than you, serve better than you, organize better than you, whatever that better is. Rather than
me, I was here first.
You know, love does no harm to its neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love others as much as you already love yourself. And do this, verse 11, live in the light of Christ. The hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over, the day is almost here, so let us put aside the deeds of darkness, put on the armor of light. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. No. Rather, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ
Do not even think
about how to gratify the desires of the sinful nature. Sin, salvation, sanctification, sovereignty, and service. These are the chapters which reveal how much of sin, salvation, sanctification, and sovereignty we really get. Which is why, if you find that you cannot bless those who persecute you, if you find that you just are constantly given to taking revenge over and over, if you find that your spirit and your life is closed to others, and I want to be a voice that says, go back to sin and salvation, because you may never have gotten it. Because what we find out in sanctification, that if it's a dog, it'll bark. If it's a follower of Christ, it'll live like it. There'll be a heart. These truths will resonate with you. And they are so good, so practical, because if you are truly part of the body and relating with others, you can relate with a whole bunch of people who are sinners. That's what we are. We're a bunch of sinners. And we're going to offend each other. We're going to rub each other the wrong way. We are going to try to say something that's funny and it's not funny. It's offensive at times. And we're going to trip over our words. We're going to fail to do things that we should have done. And if you want to find reasons to get offended, man, we'll give you plenty. And then that becomes the occasion for you to say, do I really believe this? And if you do, then maybe in your mind, in fact, maybe even on your own computer, you have some delete buttons to hit and some files to take to the cross and say, I'm not judge. I'm just a sinner. Saved by His grace, made His child. And what I have is better than I deserve. But how do we get along when we don't agree on everything? That's next Sunday night. That's chapter 14. Father, thank You for using the hard circumstances of life to reveal the desires of our hearts. Thank You that in being sinned against, we have opportunities to see the evil arrogance and bitterness of a heart that lies at times just beneath the surface. And it is so gracious of you to reveal that. Though our heart wants to scream at you that it's not fair. But you are so gracious to keep working on our lives, the person of Christ into our very being, and kneading that into the very dough of our hearts. You just bring Christ to bear upon us. Thank you. Thank you for the gospel that forgives us, that cleanses us, that forgives our enemies, and that at the foot of the cross we can embrace as a friend. You know, and you point out what each of us needs tonight. And now we come before you and are confronted with what we will do. Lord, help us to really believe the gospel.